Hello, and welcome to Assassinations Podcast. This is the second and concluding part of our look at the life and death of Robert Maxwell, the British media magnate and corporate criminal. Last week, we looked at the twists and turns of Maxwell's life and career, and we considered his connections, confirmed or alleged, to various government personnel and spying agencies in Israel, the UK, and across the former Eastern Bloc. We also learned that, after his death in 1991, the full extent of his malfeasance came to light, that he'd ripped off his own workers and retirees, while amassing huge debts that could never be repaid. He committed fraud on a massive level for years, right under the nose of Britain's financial authorities. How could he have gotten away with it for so long? And we must consider something else. Under the bluster and the braggadocio, was there a real Robert Maxwell with any true loyalties? To consider these questions, we're going to travel back to that fateful night in November of 1991, when we will board the luxury yacht, the Lady Ghislaine, and then set sail for that undiscovered country in the company of Robert Maxwell.
Welcome to Assassinations Podcast, where we delve into some of history's most notorious political killings and explore the mysteries and conspiracies that surround them. Time and again, assassins have wielded the blade, the poison vial, the bullet, and the bomb to shape the course of history. I'm your host, Neil Cooper, and in this podcast, I'm going to investigate the lives and deaths of some of history's most colourful characters.
After his mysterious death, the Potemkin village of Robert Maxwell's empire came tumbling down. A man who had presented himself as a media mogul and political heavyweight turned out to be a broke fraudster who had ripped off his own employees and amassed debts to the tune of £2 billion. That's billions with a B. In today's money, approximately £4.3 billion, or $5.3 billion, in debts that would never, could never be fully repaid, even after his business went bankrupt and his assets were seized. How had Maxwell gained access to such a vast reserve of capital, much of it borrowed, some of it stolen? Were no alarm bells set a-ringing? Or might he have been on the receiving end of some seriously special treatment? Maybe the answer lies in his involvement in the shadowy realms of espionage and covert international diplomacy. Robert Maxwell, aka Cap'n Bob, aka the Bouncing Chick, aka Ivan du Maurier, aka Jan Ludwig Hyman Benjamin Hawk, was born in Czechoslovakia in 1923. Thereafter, his life was a melange of identities and professions. A soldier, awarded one of Britain's highest honours for valour. An army press officer with ties to Eastern Europe. An asset of British intelligence. A media entrepreneur. A member of parliament. And one of the most flamboyant characters of his era. He was accused of being a spy for Israel and the Soviet Union, and of using his covert activities to feather his own nest. After his death, an editor of one of his newspapers, who had worked under him for 5 years, described Maxwell as a sociopath. Others, including those he ripped off, were less kind. In the end, did a lifetime of shady activities catch up with him? Or did Maxwell simply fall off the side of his yacht? An anticlimactic end to an extraordinary life. Let's imagine two scenarios, starting with the more prosaic. On November 4th, 1991, Maxwell has a belligerent phone call with his son Kevin. But there's nothing unusual about that. The word belligerent and the name Robert Maxwell are virtual synonyms. That said, this exchange is especially fraught. Kevin entreats his father to remain in the UK to attend a scheduled meeting with the Bank of England. Maxwell is about to default on £50 million in loans. His companies are on the verge of collapse. His carefully crafted image as a savvy businessman is on the brink of ruin. Maxwell has decided to miss this crucial meeting. Instead, he tells his exasperated son he will be travelling to his yacht, the Lady Ghislaine, moored off the coast of Gran Canaria, one of the Spanish Canary Islands. On November 5th, Maxwell boards the yacht, alone, except for the crew. What thoughts trouble his mind? He knows he's now in deep trouble. His empire, which he had built up from a tiny publishing company to a stable of newspapers and international publishers, printers, language programs, and television interests, is collapsing around him. He tried to push hard into the American media market. It was, alas, a gamble that failed to pay off. The cash cow of his portfolio is Mirror Group Newspapers. But he has raided that business, and the pensions of its workers, to the tune of hundreds of millions of pounds. There's really not that much left to take from it. For most crooked businessmen, this would be the end of the road. But Bob Maxwell is no ordinary man. It is not uncommon for the wealthy to have friends in high political places, but he holds sway over men and women who sit in the highest echelons. From Moscow to London to Washington to Tel Aviv, his Rolodex is a veritable who's who of post-war political life. Maxwell's business dealings across the Iron Curtain put him on first-name terms with the comrade leaders of most of Europe's Stalinist regimes. Meanwhile, in the West, he is equally at ease rubbing elbows with everyone from Margaret Thatcher to Donald Trump. After a lifetime of mixing with the elite and dealing with the dark forces that really run the world, he has some favours to call in. He has many a secret locked within that brilliant, scheming, multilingual, ruthless brain of his. If knowledge is power, then Maxwell is a powerful man indeed. And if a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, then his level of knowledge is a veritable nuclear arsenal. He has long been involved in passing intelligence to the West about the communists of the East. And maybe that flow of information went both ways. And this shadowy activity extended beyond the great rivalry of the Cold War. For Maxwell, born into an Orthodox Jewish Yiddish-speaking family, is also a long-time friend of Israel. Amongst other services rendered, Maxwell conducted negotiations with Soviet leaders to allow thousands of Jewish people to leave the USSR for Israel. This relationship may have extended to facilitating secret military technology transfers between the Soviet Union and Israel, even at a time when the communists were still providing aid to Palestinian militant groups. Back in Britain, rumours of his financial woes are swirling. The vultures are circling, the jackals are waiting to pounce. He takes a sip of his scotch, letting it warm him in the chill of the night.
"It's not all about the money. Money isn't everything. If there were just 50 men like me, the country would be in better shape. The ungrateful bastards."
Maxwell, his huge fleshy frame spread upon a lounger on the deck of his yacht, has always been comforted, gently rolling upon the ocean, secluded on his beloved, the Lady Ghislaine. He had been born in a rural ghetto, as poor as you could imagine, and look at him now. Look at all he had achieved. He gazes at the crystal clear sky. As he marched across Europe, from the beaches of Normandy to the ruins of Berlin, there had been many a night when he had slept in the open under the canopy of stars. Almost every member of his family, practically the entire village he had grown up in, died in the war. They were amongst the 6 million victims of the Shoah, a millennium of Yiddish culture wiped away in a decade of horror. He had sought to recreate that family in the safety and security of England. He and his wife had 9 children, one of whom had died. Most of the rest of them now work for him. But the apple of his eye is his youngest, Ghislaine, for whom this yacht is named. Sleepless, he moves from the deck to the interior around 4:30 a.m, passing a deckhand on watch. At 8 a.m, breakfast is brought to his suite, but Maxwell is nowhere to be seen. After a while, his concerned crew searches the boat. Nothing. He has vanished. His nude body is later recovered by fishermen from the Atlantic Ocean on the evening of November 5th. It is taken ashore and then on to the town of Las Palmas for medical examination. Except for a small graze on his left shoulder, there is no noticeable injury to Maxwell's body. Members of the yacht crew tell an eager media that it was common practice for their former boss to urinate, nude, into the ocean at night. So, he fell over, right? Just a simple, silly accident. Of course, almost every time there is a high-profile death, the rumour mill and the conspiracy-minded spring into action. Some suspected suicide, especially when the full scale of his financial crimes became clear. And if he had returned to the UK, it might only have been a matter of time before he declared bankruptcy, at which point his massive defrauding of the Mirror Pension Fund would have been exposed. Even a man of Maxwell's stature could face jail time for defrauding pensioners of hundreds of millions of pounds. But his family and many of those who had worked under him doubted that Maxwell would have taken his own life. He'd faced many a high and low over the years. He'd overrun a German machine gun post. He'd been forced out of his own company in the 1970s. When he also lost his parliamentary seat, and he'd purchased businesses that tanked. But he'd always found a way to pull through. His gargantuan ego and fierce ambition were such that suicide seemed unthinkable to those who had witnessed firsthand the full force of his will. The editorial director of his newspaper group, Charles Wilson, said that he could not imagine any situation that would cause Maxwell to take his own life. He had too much of the arrogance of his own ability to conceive of such a thing, Wilson said. From Gran Canaria, Maxwell's body was not flown home to England, but to Israel. On November 9th, an autopsy was conducted by 3 Israeli and 2 British doctors. The result of the autopsy was never revealed, because it was carried out at the request of the insurance companies that provided a $37 million accidental death policy for the entrepreneur. 1 month after Maxwell's demise, a British inquest ruled that the cause of death was a heart attack combined with accidental drowning. However, 3 pathologists who gave evidence were unable to agree on the cause of death. Aged 68 and weighing in at around £280, Maxwell had long suffered from pretty serious heart and lung conditions. Men in such a state of health, and with the enormous strain that he must have been under, are likely victims of heart attack. Murder was ruled out by the judge at the inquest, as was suicide. So, that was it. Case closed. Nothing to see here, folks. Except, at Assassinations Podcast, we have to pull back the curtain just a little bit further to see what other actors might be waiting in the wings. But before we do so, let's take a break. Exclusively for our Patreon supporters, I have a bonus episode to accompany this investigation. In it, I will look at the life of Robert Maxwell's daughter, Ghislaine. She's been in the news of late. The intimate friend of the recently deceased Jeffrey Epstein, and the good chum of Britain's Prince Andrew, Ghislaine has been accused of acting as a madam, or procurer of girls and young women, working alongside Epstein in an international human trafficking and sexual slavery operation that catered to the debased urges of a global elite. Wanted for questioning in Britain and America, she has disappeared from public view. She is seemingly now hiding out in a luxury villa near Tel Aviv, Israel, under round-the-clock armed guard by a team of elite ex-Special Forces mercenaries. Was she, perhaps like her father, an agent of Israeli intelligence? Was she engaged in a hideous blackmail operation, garnering shocking, career-ruining intel on prime ministers, presidents, and princes from around the world? We will explore these questions in the bonus episode, which comes out on Friday, May 1st. To gain access, just go to patreon.com/assassinationspodcast. For as little as $1 per month, you can listen to this and many other Patreon-exclusive bonuses. Now, back to the show. What if Robert Maxwell had not met such a mundane end? What if his past had caught up with him with the full brutality that is the hallmark of the nefarious realm in which he spent most of his life? After all, he swam with sharks long before he plunged into the ocean. Maxwell touches down in Gran Canaria and is soon aboard the Lady Ghislaine. The weight of the world is upon his shoulders. He has prided himself that, Through a career of dizzying highs and abyssal lows, he has fought through by hook or by crook. Has he taken chances? Yes, he is a risk taker, as are all great men. Has every gamble paid off? No, but even the greatest generals sometimes lose a battle. The war is not yet over, though. He has seen real war, its full horrors, from the blood-soaked sands of the Allied invasion of France, to the grisly battles in which he fought and led men to their deaths, to the charred remnants of Hitler's Reich. Field Marshal Montgomery had pinned a military cross on his chest for valour on the battlefield. That was back when Britain rewarded those who served her. He has known real loss, loss such as the minnows who now pursue him could not fathom. The creditors are nipping at his heels, the police would come knocking, then financial regulators, number crunchers, they'd go pecking over his books. His cowardly, two-faced friends would distance themselves from him. His underlings would defy him. Even his own children might rebel. Prison? A real possibility. The stakes could hardly be higher. But high-stakes games suit Robert Maxwell. He's played them all his life. Glorious triumph, or utter defeat. That was what he faced. Victory, or death. He has called in favours, from around the world and across the spectra of ideology and nationality. Maxwell has a network that operates above and beyond the law. For the better part of 5 decades, he has served the interests of British intelligence. And how is he to be repaid? To be hauled before the bureaucrats at the Bank of England? It was beneath his dignity to be summoned to such a meeting. The services he has rendered to his adopted country are beyond measure. They should be giving him another medal, not a reprimand. He has put the establishment on notice. He knows what they do not want the public to know. With a word, with an order to one of his newspapers, secrets could be revealed that would shake the United Kingdom to its core. The Prime Minister, the heads of the intelligence agencies, and other names known to him but not to the public, understand that Maxwell is not a man to be trifled with. Nor has he limited his demands to the British elite. No, his reach extends throughout a shadow world that recognises no borders. His Soviet friends owe him too. His publishing house has written hagiographies of leading communists, and he has helped many a comrade to feather his nest. The Iron Curtain might have come down, and the Soviet Union is now on its last buckling leg. But from the wreckage of Stalinism rises a new capitalist class, the oligarchs. And the ruthless agents of the KGB remain, behind the scenes, still very much in power. As they liquidate the state-owned wealth of the people, surely they can spare a little bridging loan for Maxwell, a man who has helped them out so much in the past. And then, there is Israel. How could they deny him aid? Were it not for his efforts in 1947, there might very well not be an Israel. The aircraft parts he smuggled from Czechoslovakia to the fledgling state were absolutely vital to the ability of the Zionist cause to crush the opposition of the Arabs. This relationship was renewed in 1983, when Mossad asked him to serve the Jewish homeland yet again. He became Israel's super spy, a keeper of secrets, an unofficial emissary, and a conduit for less than kosher financial transactions through which illicit monies were laundered by a series of companies with which Maxwell was involved. In the past 8 years, he has provided Israel with the fruits of industrial espionage, strengthening their security and developing the country's economy. And what of the thousands of Jews who have left the USSR for Israel, thanks in no small part to his ministrations in Moscow? Such services were priceless. The Jewish homeland would not abandon one of its most devoted sons in his hour of need, surely? All he asked for was a small, one-time £400 million payoff to see him through this rough spell. Just in case anyone happens to forget just how vital he has been to the Israeli cause, Maxwell has gently reminded his acquaintances in Mossad that he has not forgotten all that he has done for them over the years. He takes a sip of his whiskey, letting it warm him. The time for reflection is done, though. The time for action is here. Embittered but determined, Maxwell heaves his great frame from the lounger and retreats to his suite. A couple of hours sleep, then a new day, and a new phase of the battle that he will surely fight, might and main, to the very end. Inside, unknown men are waiting. They have been sent to extract information. This they do, skillfully, ruthlessly. And then they silence an errant son and commit his body to the waves. In January of 1992, the French magazine Paris Match published several graphic pictures of Maxwell's body, which it said it had received from an anonymous source who had been involved in the autopsy performed in Israel on November the 9th. The pictures clearly show bruises, casting doubt on the official story of what happened on the Lady Ghislaine in the last moments of his life. The magazine said the photos were taken from a videotape made during the autopsy in Israel, just before Maxwell was buried in Jerusalem. Paris Match said the autopsy found several bruises on Maxwell's face, shoulders, stomach, and calves, indicating that he was beaten before he fell or was thrown from his yacht. "We showed the pictures to French experts," the magazine story claimed. The experts were explicit. The multiple bruises on the body of the ex-press magnate indicate he was attacked before his death. A French police forensic specialist was quoted as saying, "According to the photos, it is highly probable that the victim was hit in the back of the head with a blunt instrument." However, these same experts believed that the injuries alone appeared insufficient to have caused Maxwell's death, and that he most likely died after hitting the water. A spokesperson for Dr. Ian West, a British physician who participated in the Israeli autopsy, said that he had no comment on the photos showing the bruising, except to say that the magazine story, quote, "contains a number of inaccuracies." Robert Maxwell was accorded the next best thing to a state funeral in Israel. In attendance were the Prime Minister, Yitzhak Shamir, the President, Chaim Herzog, 6 serving or former heads of Israeli intelligence, and numerous other prominent persons from the fields of business and politics. Maxwell was laid to rest on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem, buried alongside some of those regarded by the State of Israel as its greatest heroes. President Herzog delivered the eulogy. "He scaled the heights. Kings and barons besieged his doorstep. He was a figure of almost mythological stature, an actor on the world stage, bestriding the globe, as Shakespeare says, like a colossus." Ah, praise indeed. Though perhaps we should also bear in mind the wisdom of Solomon, for it is written in the book of Proverbs, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy." Thank you for listening to this episode of Assassinations Podcast. This was the second and concluding part of our look at the life and death of Robert Maxwell. As I mentioned in the mid-roll of the show, a bonus to accompany this investigation will be available on our Patreon page this Friday, May 1st. To gain access, just go to patreon.com/assassinationspodcast. I have a rather special little announcement to make. This week marks the 2-year anniversary of Assassinations Podcast. It kind of snuck up on me. It's been a great experience making this show. I've learned so much, I've spoken to a lot of interesting people, and I hope that y'all have enjoyed voyaging through the darker side of history with me. Over these 2 years, many people have kindly gone to iTunes or their podcatcher of choice to leave the show a rating or review. If you haven't already, then I'd like to ask you to take this opportunity to do that. Ratings and reviews might help other people find the show, which would be lovely. Please join me next week for a very special episode, in which I interview noted historian, folklorist and investigator Andy Thomas. We discuss his book, Conspiracies, a fascinating read that looks at many of the most controversial cases, including several famous assassinations that I have covered or soon will be covering. And I really do hope you'll join me. That episode comes out next week. Until then, goodbye.